or pure financial speculation. Of course, given the importance of what you call oil and other commodities for Canada economy, which accounts for roughly 10% of GDP, 5% of employment, and 45% of export, fluctuation in commodity price important implication for Canada's terms of trade, inflation, and real economic activity. Needless to say, of course, commodity prices have significant implication for monetary policy. Therefore, studying, understanding of what drives commodity prices, especially oil prices, and how best to forecast them is a key area of research and analysis at the Bank of Canada. In today's presentation, I am going to focus on oil markets, but of course other commodities are also important. But what I say about oil markets, basically it's true for other markets as well. First, I am going to highlight some recent market developments in oil markets and work we have been undertaking to better understand the key driver of oil prices. Then I will specifically start with summarizing some stylized facts observed in the oil markets. Then I will move to the topic of financialization of commodities and try to look at its benefits and costs. Following the financialization debate, I will explore some of the issues in macroeconomic fundamentals. Then I will try to look at the regulatory measures which are designed to increase transparency in physical market in both sides of Atlantic. Let me start by showing you some stylized facts that we observe about oil markets first. First, oil prices are historically elevated, although they are lower than their 2008 peaks in the real terms. They have higher than in the 1970s, and in fact, higher than observed in the last 100 years. This is basically, it was the slide before this one showing the real prices, and this one showing the nominal prices. Nominal prices, as you see, reached its peak in 2008, July of 2008, $147, although it went down to $32 in less than 6 months, then it went up again, now it's about $100. Second stylized fact is the perception of increased volatility. Prices for oil, like those for many other commodities, are inherently volatile, and volatility itself varies over time. The experience of financial crisis, in which prices rose to nearly $150, then fell to nearly $30, has led to a perception that oil prices are very volatile, and the volatility is really a bad thing. However, our conditional volatility estimation suggests that the increase in volatility observed during 2008 and 2009 was a temporary phenomenon, and that volatility in the oil market remains consistent with historical average. It is interesting to note that volatility increases as oil prices decline, and that it declines as oil price increase, a pattern that is consistent with the empirical evidence in the stock market. Basically, the idea is that the increase in volatility when oil prices fall can be explained by the fact that falling oil prices often accompany deteriorating global activity and resulting uncertainties for global oil demand, such as the collapse in demand observed immediately after the demise of Lehman Brothers in September 2008. The next stylized fact is the increase in oil prices has coincided with an increase in the market shares of financial players, especially hedge funds. This is what is commonly known as financialization. Here, this slide shown by also David, Jeff, and again David Five, increased participation of index traders. Not only did hedge funds increase their presence in commodity derivatives markets, in particular oil derivatives markets, but also commodity index investment by commodity index traders increased from $55 billion in late 2004 to reach high of $442 billion in June 2012, before it fell to $349 billion in June of 2013. Here we have basically our Stalite Fact 5, the coincident rise in crude oil prices and increased number of financial participants in the crude oil market has led to the belief that speculators drive the crude oil prices. This is supported by the strong correlation between net money managers' position and price. The final stylized fact is the increased correlation between asset classes, especially commodities, equities, and equities. We have observed increased correlation among commodities and equities, which some suggest is one of the consequences of financialization. Again, there is a perception that the rise in the level and the volatility of oil prices can be attributed to the financialization of oil markets. There are several theories on the drivers of oil prices, but we can group these theories into two specific categories. First one is the financialization of oil markets, evidenced by the rapid growth of investment in commodities by financial players. And the second one is fundamentals and the expectations about these fundamentals. Let me first discuss the hypothesis that financialization of oil market has become a key driver of oil prices. For this, I am going to define financialization as an increasing exposure to commodities by a wide set of market participants, such as hedge funds, pension funds, insurance companies, and retail investors. While some people argue that financialization has become relevant with the rapid growth of commodity index investment around 2004, others see the emergence of hedge funds, index funds, and electronic trading, and exchange-traded funds, and exchange-traded notes as part of the process, therefore date the starting point at around 2002. But in generally, we, in academic, we argue that it's around 2004 financialization started. Since the possible impact of financialization and speculation on oil prices has been driving in part the regulatory agenda by G20, let me start with the possible consequences of financialization. Potential positive consequences for financialization we might count include more efficient derivatives pricing methods through linking future prices at different maturities. This is supported by my own research with Jeff and Michelle Robb, 2008, and we later on updated 2010. And another possible benefits might include the helping physical crude oil markets become more integrated by reducing transaction costs and facilitate arbitrage across geographically distant markets and across crude oil of different quality. Finally, but not least, reducing the market price of risk with stabilizing effect on the oil price. However, there might be potential negative consequences of financialization, as some have claimed, and that might include divergence of prices from fundamentals, possibly leading to emergence of bubbles, and excessive volatility and erosion of long-run diversification benefits of commodities. Since the potential costs are main worry, let me look at the whether empirical evidence is supportive of these effects. Let's start with the first two possible effects of financialization, namely its influence on prices and volatility. Recent research, including my own research, show that speculative activity does not lead to price changes. In fact, the presence of financial players reduces volatility by enhancing market liquidity. But some others find, for example, Singleton finds that increasing flows into index funds predict higher subsequent futures return. However, his results are based on a debatable measure of investment flows into the index fund. Furthermore, predictability need not imply causation. There is another evidence that is inconsistent with the view that financialization is the driving reason for high prices. For example, if we look at non-exchange traded commodities, price increase in... What happened? Sorry, I can't show the... graphs here. If you have the paper copies, graphs over there showing that, let me see, non-exchange traded commodities, basically volatility in non-exchange traded commodities where we don't see any speculators, actually higher than exchange traded commodities. All right. The other argument is that the financialization encourages herding behavior in oil markets with destabilizing consequences. However, as suggested by Jeff Harris, our findings suggest that herding among hedge funds is countercyclical and that it has not destabilized the oil markets during recent years. Next, consequences of financialization. Some argue that basically financialization broke the negative relationship between inventories and prices. What we see upward slope in the post 2003 data. Generally, we have the negative relationship between inventories and prices. When inventories increase, prices decline. But after 2003 period, we see a positive relation between these two variables. However, we have to understand two facts: relationship between two endogenous variable could be shifting in response to structural change or change in expectation, and missing inventories, especially from non-OECD countries, might explain the disappearance of negative relationship between these two variables. Here is our inventory and price relationship. As you see, after 2003 period, this relationship reversed, and then now it is positive. But as I said, this relationship showing only OECD stocks and the prices. We don't have any stock information or inventory information from China and other emerging market economies. Next one is basically, let me finalize my discussion on the impact of financialization on increased correlation between different asset classes. My own research and some others find that activities of financial players, commodity prices and other asset prices appear to be increasingly responding to global business condition. However, others argue that the increase in correlation is simply a part of the temporary increase in cross-asset correlation across almost all asset returns, driven by the temporary prevalence of the common factor, namely the risk-on factor. Basically, the bottom line is that while we have observed an increase in the financialization of oil markets and more generally commodity markets, the weight of the existing evidence is that the financialization is not the main explanation behind the increase in oil prices over the last decade. So, if financialization, or in a narrower sense, speculation, did not drive prices from their fundamental values, then how can we explain elevated commodity prices? That is, why is the price of oil, which was $30 in 2003, and now it is $100? Starting in 2003 and more strongly after 2004, we would argue that given the low price elasticities of supply and demand, a demand shock pushed upward the price of most commodities, including non-exchange traded commodities. In a recent review paper by Lutz Killian, Basim Fatu and Lavan Mahadeva suggested that the existing evidence is not supportive of an important role for speculation in driving the spot prices of oil after 2003. Instead, there is a strong evidence that the co-movement between the spot and future prices reflects common economic fundamentals rather than the financialization of oil futures markets. So, how can we explain this? If financialization is not the main driving reason for high oil prices, in a word, it's China. For example, this chart shows the demand for crude oil from the US and China, along with the price for West Texas intermediates. Over the past decade, oil prices have been rising with the Chinese demand, while US demand has in fact slumped, falling below its 2002 level. Strong demand growth has also occurred in many other emerging market economies. This phenomenon has been described by some as a commodity price supercycle. This suggests that oil market fundamentals, such as the demand growth in emerging market economies, especially in China, inventories outside of the OECD, and rising cost of production can explain large part of run-up in prices over the last decade. The current commodity price supercycle began in early 2000s due to predominantly to rapidly rising demand associated with the phenomenal economic growth experienced by many emerging market economies, complemented by a rapid rate of urbanization. Some suggested, like David, this supercycle may be coming to an end. It is because basically they suggested above-trend commodity prices pattern strongly driven by demand from China, a key factor behind the slump in commodity prices in 2013 has been the declining growth performance of China. That's why slowing Chinese growth might be one reason why we can call the end of commodity supercycle. And second reason is given by OECD demand growth is expected to be negative for the next 5 years. And in the rich world, oil demand has already peaked and it has fallen since 2005. And the efficiency gains will further curb the demand for oil and natural gas. This might be another reason why we might call the end of commodity supercycle. Another reason given may be substantially positive supply shock due to fracking and all this stuff in the future, led by the North American oil and natural gas boom, might be one another reason why commodity supercycle come to an end. However, we believe that commodity supercycle is far from over. Chinese economy is slowing, not contracting, and still shows robust growth by any measure. If China is growing 7.5% today, starting from a much larger base, this actually generates a similar absolute increase in demand as when China was growing at 14%. just before the crisis, but from a lower base. Moreover, consumer-led growth will continue to require raw materials such as cars, consumer electronics, and white household goods, all of which are made from metals. Moreover, urbanization will continue, and with it, demand for commodities. In fact, urbanization still has a long way to go for key emerging market economies. The rising prices over the last decade are owed in large part to the enormous demand created by the resource-intensive process of urbanization led by China. The demand for commodities is expected to be supported by continued urbanization and developments in emerging market economy. Let us look at the urbanization story. The abundant labor supply in countryside has led to massive process of urbanization and set to continue for decades. For example, the urban population in China has increased by 360 million people since 1990, and another 350 million people can be expected to live in urban areas by 2050. And we have to add to this one the India. India is basically is expected to add another 500 million people in their urban population by 2050. And we are expecting robust population growth in these countries. Between 2010 and 2020, for example, world population is expected to rise by about 800 million. And economic growth, likewise, in the emerging market economies, remains supportive of commodity demand. Rising income in EMEs continue to boost commodity consumption. Not only demand is increasing, but also cost of supply is increasing. Basically, while supply capacity for key commodities such as base metals, crude oil, and natural gas has increased rapidly in recent years, most of these new supplies are considered the marginal resources and they are more costly to produce. Okay, let me move to my final remarks. In a rapidly changing oil market where demand is moving east while supply is moving west, measures to enhance the transparency of data provision to regulators on prices, trading activity, and other factors affecting the supply and demand of individual commodities are broadly welcomed. 2008 financial crisis has spurred efforts to address limited data availability in commodity derivatives market. However, we have to recognize that price discovery generally takes place in derivatives markets, which themselves use the perceptions on current physical demand and supply condition as well as expectation of future conditions. Therefore, more international coordination is needed to make headway in increasing the availability of timely and reliable data in physical markets. Basically, we have the very limited data from physical markets on prices, supply, demand, inventories, and transportation, and production and storage costs. Especially, I really like the quote by James Smith, who is the editor of Energy Journal, who suggests that, okay, yes, you might actually achieve your goals by reducing the volatility by position limit or something, but this is only you can hope for it. The sure way to reduce volatility is to increase transparency in physical markets, especially the inventory and all this stuff. Financial players always use information from physical market, but these information are always noisy. Once the noise is gone, you see most of the time you can explain the change in prices by just looking at the fundamentals. First, let me a few remarks on IASCO's principle for oil reporting agencies and financial benchmark. Basically, they are the concrete initiatives to increase transparency in physical market prices. For example, there are some other initiatives by Energy Information Forum and all this stuff, Jody Gas, Jody Oil and all this stuff. But this is one concrete example how we can increase transparency in physical market prices. However, these principles still have some limitation. First, let me talk about a little bit about the limitation. While a step forward, these principles still do not fully address the problem of selective reporting, price reporting. Since traders are not required to submit trade data to PRAs, there is a risk that voluntary reporting could result in selective reporting and seriously compromise the integrity of price assessment. Therefore, it is important to allow PRAs to use more information than concluded transaction in making their price assessments. Exclusive reliance on concluded transaction might lead to inaccurate price assessment if submitted prices are false or manipulated, like we saw in the latest UK wholesale natural gas price manipulation case. Thanks to the use of other market information, PRA can check the accuracy of submission or assess whether submitted prices truly reflect the marketplace. Demanding traders who choose to voluntarily submit data to provide all of their market data in order to prevent selective reporting is not the answer. Given the voluntary nature of trade reporting, asking traders to submit all of their data amounts to an all or nothing policy, which runs the risk of effectively discouraging price reporting and drastically limiting the pool of information available to PRAs, thereby adversely affecting the reliability of their reports. As long as submission of data is voluntary, there is a strong risk that such all or nothing policy could end up fatally disrupting the flow of information from submitters to PRAs. Another weakness in this principle has to do with the complaint handlings. While the principle do call for a formal complaint handling policy, the principle stop short from requiring the disclosure of complaints to market participants. The principles require PRAs to advise plaintiffs and any other relevant parties to the of the outcome of the investigation in the event of a formal complaint. Disputes regarding a daily pricing determination will be communicated to the market only when a complaint results in a change in price. However, if the aim of this principle is to increase transparency in price assessment, it may be argued that they should have called for an immediate announcement of all accepted formal complaints to the marketplace, market participant, similar to error trade announcement in exchanges. Furthermore, the principle called for recourse to an independent third-party review of complaints if the plaintiff is dissatisfied with a way of complaint has been handled by the relevant PRA. However, the principles require that the independent third party be appointed by the PRA itself. Giving the right to appoint the third party to the PRA to review its own decision clearly creates a conflict of interest and undermines the independence of external review. To ensure an independent review process, the appointment of the third party reviewer should be jointly handled by the PRA and the industry stakeholders. Let me give some concluding remark and then finish my presentation. Basically, in my presentation, I argue that activities of financial players appear to be increasingly responding to unexpected global business conditions rather than driving the prices. Second, benefits of financialization exceeds cost. Third, economic fundamentals, in particular demand factors, drive commodity prices. Fourth, current commodity supercycle is expected to continue at least in the near future. Maybe we are living in a cycle within a cycle, but we expect that commodity prices will be elevated for some time. And we need a more transparent physical market. We write a lot of rules to increase transparency in financial market by Dodd-Frank or other EMIR, but still we are far, far away from transparency in physical market. So we need to increase physical market transparency by increasing inventory, supply, demand, and all the storage and all this stuff. And we need to have more international coordination for this reason. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thanks so much indeed, Bahati. I thought that was an excellent overview of the issues and a super summary of where we stand. And I think it's probably fair to say that that summary reflects the kind of mainstream views of financial services regulators. Not universally, of course, but that's probably a good reflection of the mainstream position. Certainly on the macroeconomic questions. Let me hand over to Scott, and let's get the CFTC's perspective on many of these issues. CFTC, of course, is perhaps the primary regulatory force in this space. It's certainly the only markets regulated with the word commodities in their title, so gives you at least some positional insight. Scott.
Thank you very much, David. I'd like to thank my fellow panelists for setting the stage for kind of my remarks. I have the last position. I don't have a presentation. I get to summarize, because if you saw another slide about the role of index traders, you'd probably be disappointed, because they've covered it. They've covered the data. They've covered the information and where the markets are today. So let me give you some sense of where, as regulators, David touched on many good points, where IOSCO is, where the FCA has been. I'd like to provide some of the framework for where the CFTC, and in particular at the end, I'd like to cover some of the issues that I am focused on as an individual. We're a five-member commission. I obviously am one of those commission members, and we each play a different role and have a different series of interests and ideas and priorities. And I'll share with you today kind of what I'm working on, largely in the space of technology and the role that technology can play, including data. As my panelists have said, and I think made the very strong case, these markets are very important, as Jeff Harris pointed out. Forward-looking can explain what's going on in the future, and telegraphing important messages from the market about supply and demand. And they provide price discovery for goods. Well-functioning markets will assist in stabilizing prices, in my belief, and providing important supply and demand signals. They're an important place, as David Fife pointed out, for producers and merchants to hedge their commercial risks. And commodity futures contracts should be developed and developed by the exchanges to serve a variety of different commercial purposes. Now, the role of the regulator is to ensure that there are stable and orderly markets and free from fraud and manipulation. Our job is to ensure that these markets promote price discovery and that hedging opportunity, and I think is very important to stabilizing prices. Now, we are not a price-setting agency. That is not our mandate. We are not here to set prices, control prices, reduce volatility. Our job really is to, in my opinion, can do more to support transparency into the market. What are the drivers facilitating price movements? Help end users, other regulators, ourselves interpret the data. But by and large, our job is to prevent against manipulation in the market and to make sure that these are well-functioning, orderly markets. Now, obviously, after the financial crisis, people looked at the futures market and said, we really need to apply something similar to the over-the-counter market, this vast $600 trillion notional global over-the-counter market that has received so much attention. And I think the G20 was really first to the mark by pointing out in Pittsburgh back in September of 2009 that there needed to be two features. One, they had a declaration that all standardized OTC derivatives contracts should be cleared through centralized counterparties by 2012, and to the extent possible, or as appropriate, I think the language is, that they ought to be exchange traded. Now, there are some other features around data as well, but another element to that, people like to mention the G20 meeting, and to Bahattin's point, the importance of improving physical data. That too was a Pittsburgh communique objective, and I think we've worked very hard, and we can talk about all the Dodd-Frank reforms, but where we are lacking, as Bahattin correctly points out, we have not done enough to improve physical market transparency, and I think a lot of that has to do there is the responsibility of non-OECD nations to improve storage capacity, utilization, production, supply, demand figures on par with the U.S. and the EIA and the IEA internationally. Those would go a long way to helping understand physical market flows. I also believe that the PRA work is a component of that to help understand where the transactions are, but I think we really need to make substantial progress in the physical markets, and that's easy for me to say because I think we, as in the United States through the EIA, have done kind of have the gold standard, but I'm sure the economists would certainly be happy if we improve their data sets. So what did Dodd-Frank do? And I'm just going to go over it because many of you already are very familiar with that. Comprehensive reform that has four essential parts. Centralized clearing is critical, standardized contracts. Exchange trading of those products as appropriate. Reporting to the swap data repository or trade repositories, which is, I think, a very important fundamental goal, which I'll address later. And then higher capital requirements for uncleared products in order to manage the risk and obviously provide a strong driver to cleared products and more standardized products, which we can all manage, I think, better. We've done a lot at the CFTC to also improve transparency. As Jeff noted, we've improved the data substantially, providing large trader reports, now including commitment of trader reports and swap trader reports under our PARP 20 rules. Now, there are obviously many concerns still with market volatility, obviously driven by supply and demand features, supply constraints, and political uncertainty. And obviously the financialization, as all of my colleagues touched on, is a feature in that. We can do better, as I noted, to improve transparency and to reduce price distortions. And our partners and other nations have to be committed as well to eliminating export bans, minimizing price subsidies, and discontinuing hoarding, which I think on the physical side are important reforms as well. Now, everyone is moving at a varied pace in terms of the implementation of their respective financial reforms, and we've had very good dialogues with the CFTC, with many of our colleagues here in this room, in many nations that have put forward the EC, obviously Japan, and other nations have done a remarkable job to really put forward some important cross-border reforms. The CFTC, to give you just a little bit of background, has been also moving aggressively to keep pace with that. Back in July of last year, we put forward our own cross-border rules and talked about a path forward in which we're going to implement these things. Now, I have some concerns with the process in which we put forward these cross-border rules, and I haven't really been shy about telling that to anybody, because I think it's important, and it's important in venues like this to make sure that we are harmonized. I mean, that was the objective of the Dodd-Frank, of the G20 objectives back in Pittsburgh. It remains the goal today, and I know we have some differences both in the extent of the reforms, but also in the timing of the reforms. Now, timing is easier to fix, of course, and we have to work forward on a path forward to do that. The CFTC has finalized its own cross-border rules, talking about how it's going to implement Dodd-Frank in a ex-territorial fashion, and which has had ramifications for many participants in your jurisdictions as well. And we've heard many comments and concerns about the pace of which we've done these things and the extent to which we've done this. Now, one of the important features, these are global markets, as they've all pointed out, David and my fellow panelists have all pointed out, that these are global markets and we have to work together on this thing. So some of the concerns I think we've raised with our rules is they lacked, I think, some serious concerns regarding our own statutory directive. We have a directive that says we can only act, we can apply our rules internationally to the extent that it has a direct and significant impact on our economy. Now, unfortunately, I think we've exceeded that, and the direct and significant impact we happen to see in just about every trade. We have to ensure that we have consistent application of our rules, and we have to do our work after a very thorough review of our own cost-benefit analysis. So we've implemented these rules, and we've implemented our cross-border guidance, and people are beginning to make decisions in the trading markets about how they're going to allocate their capital and where they're going to put their liquidity. I've heard from a number of people already at this meeting and in previous meetings that they're very concerned about fractured liquidity. And that is a very serious concern because if the U.S. is making decisions that are causing people to make decisions to put capital in the U.S. versus and pull out of other jurisdictions because of regulatory uncertainty or because of expectation due to the breadth of the U.S. rules, I understand that would be problematic, and I have very serious concerns about that. And I would like to hear from you if that is the case, that you're experiencing that. And I want to make sure that we do our review of foreign jurisdictions as part of our cross-border analysis, that we hear from you as well. We've had six jurisdictions that have submitted for substitute of compliance that include the European Union, Japan, Australia, Canada, and Hong Kong, and Switzerland as well. I understand that potentially Singapore and Brazil will also submit for review before the U.S. rules go into effect, essentially on December 21st of this year. What I'd like to hear from everyone, and I'm going to take opportunities to meet bilaterally with many of these nations, I look forward to meeting with the rest of you as well, to make sure that we have good transparency into our rulemaking, that you understand where our priorities are and we understand where yours are. I want to make sure that we have an active engagement to ensure that our substitute compliance submissions are done so in a very transparent way and that we completely understand the pace and the extent of your own rulemakings. And I want to make sure that we take in the common interest and principles of international comity as we do this. So I think it would be incumbent upon us to do more in a more transparent fashion to make sure that we have the MOUs in place and that we make sure that your thoughts are included as we do these reviews. Now let me talk to you a little bit about the rules that we've implemented and some of my concerns and priorities that we have so far. We have in place, we've accepted for probably since January of this year, swap data repository reporting. And out of that, we're 9 months into this with swap dealers reporting to data repositories. And we've received a lot of great informative data. That doesn't mean everything's fine. Some of our data could be better. We're now beginning to realize that we weren't as precise as we could have been. And we need to really improve the quality of the data to effectively utilize it. We moved quickly, and we have the data. But to the extent we can use it is questionable right now, and we're kind of going back to review on how to make improvements to that data, and we're using the Technology Advisory Committee within the CFTC, which is an advisory group that we've assembled, and I'm the chair of that, to really make sure that we go back and answer all the questions. So we're working the swap data repositories, we're working with industry to make sure that everyone is reporting in a consistent, uniform fashion and to harmonize that language of reporting, that harmonize the data so we can use it effectively when it comes to sharing of the data with fellow regulators. We can show you where we've made mistakes and how not to make the same mistakes, and of course that'll increase the speed of uptake and utilization if we're able to be successful. We're making progress, but we need to go much faster and cover more asset classes and cover more fields. The issue of swap execution facilities, the U.S. has finalized its rule recently with regard to the swap execution facilities, and I think we've done a fairly good job with regard to establishing platforms that are flexible to encourage on-screen trading. We have a very aggressive agenda to begin on-screen trading is probably as early as next year through a mandatory requirement, but beginning October 2nd, a lot of these platforms will be registered and people, U.S. persons, will be trading on these platforms as soon as October. So we'll begin to see some of those developments as they come along. We do have flexible platforms. We've included voice, we've included RFQs, which are these requests for quotes, and we've included limit order books. We have about 15 applications we've received thus far. We've approved approximately seven platforms for temporary registration. So I think we're going to have, in October, a fairly good amount of platforms ready to trade. We'll have to see how successful we are. We've heard from a lot of people, a lot of market participants that are not able to make the transition as quickly as we had hoped. There are some concerns regarding data reporting because beginning October 2nd, the swap dealers who have been reporting to the swap data repositories, that responsibility now goes to the swap execution facilities. And I'm afraid that those facilities are not ready to report all asset classes that they might have expected. I think they were. I think people expected a later implementation date for these platforms, and have not been able to make all the technical adjustments. I know that the registration requirement of October 2nd in our rules has caught many people by surprise. I think especially internationally, what we've been hearing recently is that international players, U.S. market participants or U.S. persons that have been trading internationally now believe they have a strict mandate to trade only on swap execution facilities in the United States. And to the extent that foreign jurisdictions that have execution facilities that are not prepared to register with the United States, I think felt, and I believe appropriately so, surprised that there would be an October 2nd deadline. So we've heard from a number of international players, we've heard from a number of market participants regarding this October 2nd deadline, and I believe there are some real serious concerns with that deadline, and we may need to delay that. Discussions are going on right now at the commission level, and we're trying to figure out what the appropriate delay is and for whom. The chairman will play a big role in this, and we'll have to see what his decision is in terms of delaying that implementation. Another area in the technology space that I think is very important is in terms of automated trading. We've spent a considerable amount of time looking at automated trading, and I think a couple of times it's been mentioned here is high-frequency trading. We're not only looking at solely high-frequency trading, the fastest of the fast traders, but we're looking at all aspects of automated, as has been noted on these panels. The move out of pits and onto a screen is pervasive, and in our markets, it's over 90% of our trading. I suspect that is obviously something that you've seen in your markets as well, or will see, and that is our new reality. For technology for us to adjust to that technology is important. We're beginning to develop better rules around that. Last week, we submitted a commission proposal, a concept release. It's pre-rulemaking. It's a concept release in which we ask over 100 questions about different roles that automated traders play, as well as what are the rules in place today that people are utilizing on a pre-trade basis to prevent from runaway markets. We're very interested to understand everybody's input and concerns about what's being deployed today and what the best practices should be going forward. And I think early next year, we will probably have a proposal in a draft rule that would take the comments and the input provided by the market and fellow regulators, hopefully, to establish a best practices for automated trading. I think it's probably a year away before those rules would possibly go into effect, but I think we're going to try to make some big improvements in terms of establishing a best practices for automated trading. So that document should be available on our website as well as in the Federal Register for your review. And we'd really appreciate your thoughts and consideration, because I am very aware, following the flash crash, that that markets are interconnected, and that what happens in U.S. markets could easily happen or move to either European or Asian markets or any other markets. So to the extent we are interconnected and we are working together, your input on automated trading would be extraordinarily beneficial to us. We have another set of rules that we're going to be working on, which will have a big impact, I think, on the physical markets, and those are things around the Volcker rule and some of the review that the Federal Reserve right now is doing in surveillance of its banks regarding physical holdings and physical trading by banks and what the role is. I think David touched on it in terms of the storage capacity. What are the storage responsibilities? And you know, in keeping with my beginning thoughts, physical markets and the importance of having good, robust physical markets that are absent, that we can keep manipulation out of it. It also deals with, it's not just the trading, it's also the delivery. And right, and there's the delivery, well-designed contracts around delivering commodities to their respective markets. Storage of that is a huge component when you're discussing physical markets. So we're going to look, like the FCA, at that physical component and that storage responsibility. So that, if with the Volcker rule that we change the relationships banks have in these markets and we require them to push out different trading, to David Fife's concern, where will commercial market participants find liquidity? Banks have traditionally been that liquidity provider. How will that impact the market? How will that impact hedging, price discovery, et cetera? So I think that's a fair summary of the issues that we've been working on. Let me just reiterate the importance of technology and data. That's something that is among my highest priorities. And our ability to understand and look at the data is going to help us with the transparency in the market. I want to improve physical market data, but I know where we are today with regard to swap data repositories. We can do so much more in sharing financial market data with you, with other regulators, and having good comparable regulations to really improve our insight into over-the-counter markets, swap markets, et cetera. And then we link that with our fairly transparent futures markets. I think we're going to be much better off and have a better sense of how to develop the rules going forward. If we are going to set position limits, what should we set them on? What does the comprehensive market look like? All of these things are going to be better informed by strong data, and I'm pushing very hard to make sure that we have good quality data that can be used effectively. We will have to invest in technology because we right now use more of a 20th century regulatory model as opposed to a 21st century market strategy, but we need to adapt to that, and I believe we can do so over the next couple of years. So let me close with that. I'm happy to answer any of your questions, and thank you for your participation. And if you have any direct comments for me afterwards that you'd like to share regarding your own regulatory concerns, I'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you very much indeed, Scott, and again, very helpful to have that reminder that, as we talked about at the beginning, there's a strong link from the regulatory concerns around commodity markets, narrowly defined, to what is happening across financial markets more generally. It was very helpful to have Scott's overview of his home perspective on that. I suggest that we take a break. Now we'll have lunch. We've teed up, I think, our panel discussion very well for this afternoon. I'd like to really group our thoughts this afternoon around three overarching topics, so you can be thinking about issues that you want to raise over lunch when we come back. The first is the sort of the macroeconomic aspect. So do we fully understand how commodity and commodity derivative markets are changing? And if we don't, what are the gaps that need to be filled in? We heard a lot this morning around what our current understanding might be, but the question I think is that a complete understanding? And if it isn't, what more needs to be done to make it complete? Then there's a second strand of issues really around the regulatory microstructure. So are there other elements of the way that markets work in some detail that need further attention? So we've talked this morning around greater transparency. Well, if so, over what? We talked a bit about financial market transparency, physical market transparency, benchmarks. What's the role for more intrusive interventions like position limits? And what more do we need to do to stay on top of the changing technological aspects of financial markets? Perhaps we need to talk a bit about that more. So the regulatory microstructure. And then the third strand of issues really are sort of what I'm calling boundary challenges. So what's the appropriate interface between financial market regulators and physical regulators? How do we deal most effectively with these cross-border challenges? And have we got the right approach to financial market players versus physical market players? We're hearing this morning that actually we're seeing an increasing overlap in the different activities that those different two types of players are getting into. So financial market players have been increasingly involved in some of the physical aspects, and physical market players are extending their footprint over the transaction chain as well. So we'll come back ready for a prompt start here at 2 o'clock and enjoy your lunch. I think lunch is well signposted when you get to the lobby and I hope you enjoy that. We're back here again for a prompt start at 2. Thank you.